Hey, what's up, everybody?
And welcome back to Mile Higher Podcast, episode 294. Today, folks,
we got a wild one for you.
Yeah, we're taking you on a real journey, you could say. It's pretty interesting stuff here. For the most part, it's kind of all fun and games until it does get a bit more serious.
Well, it's usually the case when it comes to cults.
Yeah.
It kind of starts out as fun and games and some wacky philosophical ideas, and then it just gets darker as time goes on. And that's unfortunately what happens with the Raelian movement, or Raelism, and Mr. Rael himself.
Oh, yeah.
The man named behind this whole crazy alien sex cult, really, is what it is at the end of the day. But yeah, this is a bizarre one and disturbing one at the same time.
When we first started looking into it, I did not know how disturbing it was going to get, and I was a little disappointed because it was just so like funny at first, to be honest.
Yeah.
And then the more we read into it, I was like, oh my God, this is pretty fucked up.
I mean, it seems like there's really not any cults out there that don't have some dark side to them. There's always, there's not just, I guess it wouldn't be really a cult if it was just like a goofy group of people that like to role play or dress up as aliens or something. And
that sounds like LARPing.
Yeah, like a LARPing. I guess that would be like a LARPing group or something.
You wouldn't call that a cult,
right? That's not a cult, no.
So yeah. I wish we could cover a group of LARPers. That sounds more fun. But actually, this is a really interesting story. How this all happened over the years and years that it happened. And it's honestly, I'm shocked I had never heard of this one personally. And I'm curious how many of you out there have heard of this or haven't. Because it was pretty big.
It's kind of surprising when looking into this one, how many other UFO cults exist.
Yeah.
I found at least three or four different ones that we might get into later on down the road, but this has definitely kind of come to the forefront thanks to Netflix and a recent documentary that was released by French filmmakers.
Yeah, when did that come out?
This year.
Okay, very recently.
Yeah, this year it came out in the last couple months, I believe. So
it's long though. It's four parts. It did leave a lot of it out as well, but I thought it was good to just kind of summarize it all into a shorter, more compact episode for people, because it's a commitment to watch, and a lot of it has subtitles, which I know some people
a lot of the interviews are in French because the man behind this cult is from France, and a lot of the members are, especially the founding members, are from France, so there's a lot of subtitles like you mentioned. But yeah, we're going to dive deep into what Raelism is all about. So just before we get into who started Raelism.
Well, before we even get into that, I'm your host, Kendall.
Oh, hi, Kendall.
Hi.
This is Kendall.
Hello.
I'm Josh, and our producer is Janelle, in case you forgot.
What up?
Or you're new here. Welcome.
Hey,
hopefully this is not the first episode you're tuning into us
on. You were the one who wanted to start doing introductions that people should know our names.
Well, I still did it, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. Fair enough. All right. You ready?
So let's talk about real quick before we get into Mr. Claude, who is the founder of Raelism. So this Raelian movement, as it's called, was founded in 1974 after Mr. Claude, who is a sports car journalist, he ended up having an encounter with an extraterrestrial named Yahweh. You're probably like, oh God, I know where this is going.
Yeah.
Well, this group, the Raelians, believe that aliens called the Elohim created all life on Earth 25,000 years ago through a process of advanced genetic engineering and cloning. The Raelians believe that the Elohim have sent prophets to Earth throughout its history to guide human thought and achievement to reach the scientific utopia enjoyed by the Elohim on their planet. These prophets include Jesus, the Buddha, and Claude, who now goes by Rael, which was the name given to him by these aliens. His sole purpose is to guide Earth through our current age of apocalypse, where we are supposed to either finally reach the scientific achievements of the Elohim or destroy ourselves through nuclear warfare. Now, the Raelians claim to have more than 130,000 members in 120 countries. They follow Rael's every word as he directs them on all of their practices as well as how they conduct their personal lives. The group plans to build an embassy to welcome the Elohim by 2035. And get this, they even claim to have cloned human babies, which is how the Elohim have achieved eternal life, according to Mr. Claude or Rael. And they also very heavily believe in freedom around sexuality.
Yeah.
And which is in theory.
Yeah, like it doesn't sound horrible until you
until you see the extent that that freedom goes to later on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But despite presenting itself as a kooky alien religion, Raelians are extremely serious in their devotion to Rael, leading to legal issues that have forced a religious leader to flee France and Canada. But before we get ahead of ourselves, we first need to talk about this young Frenchman who met an alien in 1974.
And this French fella is named Claude Bourgeon. He was born September 30th, 1946, and raised in Amberes, France. Amberes was a staunchly Catholic town known for its beautiful countryside, and they manufacture rosary beads there. Now, Claude was born right after the Second World War, and he has no idea who his father is. That's because his mother told him his father was a Jewish refugee at one point and kept his identity hidden so the people of Amberes didn't know the truth about Claude's lineage. An Alsatian industrialist funded Claude's upbringing and was most likely his true father. He was actually having an affair with Claude's mother, Colette, but could not claim his child as his own because he had two children with his wife already. Claude describes his childhood as nothing out of the average. He grew up comfortably, but was bullied by local kids as he was, quote, weak and tiny all of his life. He was raised by his mother and Aunt Therese and was adored by the women in his family despite not getting attention from any of the girls his age, which is something that really always seemed to bother him in the early days. His Aunt Therese described Claude as, quote, he is who people tell him to be. He was more or less happy in his childhood, and the stories I told him comforted him. Though he could not physically participate with the other boys his age and was completely average in school, Claude found his passion in racing after he had won a go-kart race competition. And that's when he discovered that racing would allow him to compete without his physical restraints. But there was still an issue: girls. Claude wanted to be the center of attention, and his aunt described him as a dreamy child who would tell stories to get attention from his mother. As he got older, he couldn't get that same attention from girls that he was interested in, and that's when he started playing guitar with the deliberate purpose of bringing in the girls. Therese did say that Claude was a bit arrogant and hoped he would channel it into one of his passions. But his need for constant attention became too much for Colette, so she gave him to his Aunt Therese to raise in her own family. And even though Therese lived just down the street, Claude felt abandoned by his mother, I mean, as any child would, right? And at one point, Claude ended up winning a singing contest in Amberes, and he was particularly inspired by the Belgian singer and actor Jacques Brel. And he ended up leaving his family at age 16 to go to Paris and become a singer.
So an entertainer, star. An entertainer from birth almost.
Yep. Story. We're hearing storyteller and
singing
need for attention. I mean, these things are heading us down the cult leader path.
It's like his interests and passions all culminate into becoming a cult leader.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He's like, because this entire time he's only doing these things for the attention.
Yep.
So what better way to get attention?
Now, according to Claude, which we kind of have to take his word for the beginning of his life because there isn't that much information available, but according to him, he was living the struggling artist life for a few years, performing on the streets for cash. However, it is likely that he was financially supported by his aunt and the rich Alsatian industrialist, but Claude is the only source we have for this info again. But things started looking up for him because after playing on the streets of Paris for a few years, a talent scout thought that he was talented enough to get Claude a record deal And under the name Claude Seller, he released 5 albums that actually did pretty well, though it wasn't enough to really propel him to the level of pop star that he really wanted, that fame. But he still had another dream, race car driving. But even with his moderate success through singing, he still didn't have the funds that he needed to secure a proper race car and a crew to maintain it as well. So in May of 1971, Claude began publishing Auto Pop, which was a monthly sports car editorial with the motto, The Driver's Magazine. And that same year, Claude married his wife, his first wife, Marie Paul Christini, and they had 2 children together. In an interview published in 2003, Marie said, quote, "I thought I had married a fairly ordinary, if slightly egotistical man, not a freak." So, big letdown to her when she realized that he was, in fact, a freak.
And early on,
explaining it nicely, yeah.
Early on, really, in the course of his life and what's to come.
Mm-hmm. So Claude said that Auto Pop quickly became the #1 racing magazine in France. And of course, we can't confirm this, but it was successful enough for Claude to buy a house for the family in Paris and an office for the magazine. He actually worked up a scheme to exchange free advertising in the magazine to car companies if they let him borrow their race cars. And he would use them to compete in races and was, well, not very good. But still, Claude felt as though he was living his dream. He had a wife, he had released multiple albums, and could simultaneously support his family and race. Really, everything was coming true for him. But then between October 16th and 17th, 1973, Arab oil-producing countries announced an embargo on oil deliveries to states that supported Israel in the Yom Kippur War, including France. On November 30th, 1973, French Prime Minister Pierre Messner announced a series of dramatic measures to reduce oil in the country. Messner lowered the speed limit on French public roads and also suspended all car races and rallies. And suddenly, Claude had nothing to report on, no cars to drive, and of course, no way to make money. So things were not looking good. And at the same time, France was experiencing a surge of UFO reports. Like in the US during the 40s and 50s, which we've talked about quite a lot on this show, those living in the countryside reported UFO sightings in masses, with media attention surrounding anyone who claimed to have seen something in the sky. And one night after the oil restrictions were announced, Claude had dinner with a friend and contributor to Auto Pop. And these two discussed the UFO frenzy and how anyone who saw one could get an interview. What would be even better, though, is if someone met these aliens. And you can see where the ideas are starting to brew here. Springtime is in the air, people. And when you're bringing home fresh flowers, or maybe you just pick them on your way home, you want to be able to smell those flowers that are blooming, not your litter box if you are a cat owner. Now, many of you know, Josh and I love our cats so much. They were our first babies. They are all over the age of 10 now, and we have really tried to step up their care in the last few years as they're entering, you know, seniordom. And one of the products that we have been loving over the last few years is Pretty Litter. Now, nothing beats Pretty Litter's ability to instantly trap odor. It's ultra absorbent, it's lightweight, low dust, and 1 6-pound bag works for up to a month. And what really gives us peace of mind is that Pretty Litter's crystals change color to indicate early signs of potential illness in our cats, like urinary tract infections, kidney issues, and more. And if that wasn't enough, Pretty Litter ships free right to our door. We never run out. We never have to lug the huge kitty litter bags or tubs into our home, which take up space. And even better, we don't have to lug those huge tubs and bags from the store to our car and then into our house. Pretty Litter is really amazing. You have to try it. Go to prettylitter.com/milehigher to save 20% on your first order. That's prettylitter.com/milehigher to save 20% on your first order. Once again, prettylitter.com/milehigher. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So in December of 1973, Claude and Marie visited his Aunt Therese in Amberes. Pregnant with their first child, Aurore, the two were getting out of the city and resting with family. On December 13th, Claude decided to take a walk alone through the Puy de las Salas Mountains near the town, a mountain range of dormant volcanoes and wooded valleys in between. This also happened to be the place his friend thought to be the most likely place to encounter an alien. As he walked through one of the valleys, Claude claimed that a flying saucer descended from the sky and landed right before him. The saucer floated above the ground while a staircase extended, and a small man came out of it. Claude claimed that a tiny man walked down the staircase, and at first, Claude thought he was a boy since the being was under 5 feet tall, with greenish skin, and a goatee, which I haven't seen too many young boys with goatees, but okay. So the description of this alien is not quite on par with what many of us think of when it comes to appearances of aliens, but it just seems like, other than the greenish skin, I guess,
yeah,
is where...
That's kind of classic.
The classic alien. Although most of us think of the gray aliens, I feel like, with the large heads, big eyes, no hair. But no, Claude saw this little greenish alien. And Claude said that there was a symbol on this being's clothing and the ship. A Star of David with a swastika in the middle. Then the being introduced itself as Yahweh, the name of God given by the original Israelites. Claude asked him where he had come from, to which he responded, quote, very far away. Very specific. Claude then asked if he had been to Earth before, and the being said, I have been here very often. Yahweh told Claude that he used telepathy to get Claude to show up at this location in the mountain range, and that he had the, quote, message of truth about the origins of humankind. Yahweh said that 25,000 years ago on their home planet, which he failed to mention the name of, and we still don't know to this day what the name of the home planet for the Elohim are, which that Elohim is their pronunciation of it. I've always heard it as Elohim. Elohim.
Yeah.
Elohim, which is the Hebrew name for God. And I believe that's the Hebrew pronunciation for it. Okay. But they changed it to Elohim.
Elohim.
Instead of Elohim.
Yeah.
So
I feel like that could have just been a confusion though, on his part.
Could have been. I don't know. And Yahweh, I mean, very original here.
Mm-hmm.
But he said that the Elohim had reached a level of scientific knowledge that humans were to achieve soon. The Elohim scientists wanted to create more advanced life forms and settled on Earth as a suitable place to conduct these experiments. The Elohim placed 7 research laboratories in different areas across Pangaea and synthesized DNA from Earth's chemicals to create all life on the planet. One of these research teams was tasked with creating the most intelligent of the Earth's life forms in the shape of the Elohim, which was the creation of all humanity, basically. The government of the Elohim, though later described as loving and nonviolent in all forms, watched this progression from their planet and became fearful that humans could become more advanced than them, and the government ultimately decided to destroy all life on Earth by sending nuclear missiles. So there was an ancient apocalypse, if you want to talk about Graham Hancock's theory.
It could all tie together.
Maybe. The scientists on Earth asked one of the first men, Noah, who many of us know, to build a 3-story rocket to evacuate the planet while carrying DNA samples of every species. So a little bit different than the traditional biblical story of
Definitely.
Noah building the ark and a great flood coming. No, Noah built a 3-story rocket.
That's much cooler, though.
Makes tons of sense.
Sounds much more fun than being on a boat with a bunch of animals for a few
days. Does a rocket, I guess, they just got the DNA samples from all the species and then everybody else was just left to die when this apocalypse happened. But according to the Elohim story, following the nuclear blasts, Elohim scientists returned and dispersed the radioactivity, and then the scientists used that DNA they had preserved on Noah's Ark to recreate Earth's species. Yahweh then told Claude that the Elohim had sent different prophets to Earth at specific times so that when the species had reached a certain level of scientific achievement, they would, quote, understand the truth of their existence. And of course, among these prophets were Moses, Buddha, Muhammad, and of course, we can't forget Jesus Christ.
Big names here.
Jesus's mission was to spread the truth about the origin of mankind before the apocalypse or revelation, which the Elohim said was the time when all would be understood through science. Claude asked Yahweh why they had been watching humans for so long and why he was being told this now. And Yahweh said, again, Yahweh is still this green alien dude with the goatee talking to Mr. Claude.
Thanks for the reminder.
I'm like, Yahweh in my mind is always sends me to like Jesus and God and Christianity.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, no, this is an alien.
You gotta remind yourself of
a 5-foot alien dude with a goatee.
Yeah.
So he said they had been watching humans for so long because The Elohim loved humankind, and they wanted to find out if we would love them too someday. But they were worried that humans would choose self-destruction over meeting their celestial siblings. And they said that they chose Claude because he was born to a Catholic mother and a Jewish father, which, in their eyes, bridged the two major religions. However, Claude was not raised in a religious household, and his mind was open to the truth. Yahweh immediately instructed Claude to eliminate all mysticism and said there was a scientific explanation for everything. For example, in the biblical story where Moses parted the Red Sea, it was an Elohim spacecraft that used propulsion rays to create a path across the sea floor. Claude met with Yahweh over 6 consecutive days, continuing to ask questions and learn more about this alien species. Claude asked if Yahweh returned to his planet after each meeting, to which the being responded, "No, I return to an intergalactic ship which we use as a base that stays constantly close to Earth." Yahweh told Claude humanity must get rid of all nuclear bombs and the militaries that create war on the planet. He also told Claude to make a law that women can only have 2 children. Very weird requests.
Mm-hmm.
Women can only have 2 children. Also, just get rid of war and all the militaries on the planet.
Well, I'm guessing he meant it in a way that the Elohim were worried about overpopulation, trying to save the Earth type situation.
Right. Or I guess the two kind of work together.
Yeah.
If there's more people killed by wars.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Mm. Who really knows? It's all from the mind of Claude, so.
Well, we don't know for sure.
That's true. It could be the mind of Yahweh.
Be open-minded here, Kendall.
All right.
Yahweh told Claude that they do not get married on his planet and they enjoy, quote, making love freely based on one's preferences and that humanity should not repress homosexuality.
It's like we're loving that. That's good. I mean, there were some good parts of his whole story for sure, but then it gets
even this next view on education.
Yeah, yeah, this was good.
These aliens said their education is based on a substance that children inject to understand all knowledge, which allows them to focus on what they want to do rather than the hard work of memorization.
Which, the inject part, that's a no. But, I think it's kind of it's like a Montessori idea, right?
Focus
on what you want to do versus the hard work of memorization, like the traditional schooling versus exploring your true interests. Is that kind of what he's getting there with?
I assume so.
Yeah.
Loosely. Their planet also uses geniocracy, in which only geniuses can govern their planet, and Earth should do the same. Yahweh said that robots perform every task, so work and money do not exist on their planet. There is no crime, no poverty, and individuals can do whatever they want. Quote, "We can say that our civilization is truly a civilization of leisure, baby."
That sounds nice. What do you think a civilization like this is possible?
No.
Why not?
Well, I sometimes fantasize about the day that all the mundane tasks I hate or chores that I have to do is just done by a robot and I can enjoy more leisure time.
That's the start of the apocalypse, babe.
But will that make me lazy?
It will.
And as that technology develops, robots will do more and more and more to the point where I'm just like laying in a chair with VR goggles on all day.
Mm-hmm. That's how I envision
living in
it.
in a alternate reality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or could we still develop as humans intellectually because we have more time that we're not, we have more leisure time, we're more relaxed, we're happier people. Would the planet be better off?
I mean, you can make that
if
argument.
We all were happier and didn't have to work because robots did our work. But that would also mean we would always be in control of the robots, right?
Yeah, and that's so probably not the reality
yeah,
of how that
would
shake out.
I think that's the tough part of it, which clearly these Elohim have very good control over their robots on their planet. So,
mm-hmm. Janelle, do you think a world like this could exist?
I don't think so, because I think humans are addicted to chaos and conflict.
What? Chaos? What? Where are you
from? That doesn't sound like us.
No, but I seriously don't think there's a world in which at least, the humans as we know them now would be able to just live in peace and harmony and have robots do all of our mundane bullshit. Mm-hmm. Like, I think we would create conflict in some other way.
Just in our DNA, in our nature.
Yeah, we're also extremely selfish. So I don't see a world in which that would work, unfortunately.
Yeah, I don't either. But it does sound great.
Yeah, sounds great.
A civilization that is truly a civilization of leisure.
Do you think there could be an extraterrestrial civilization that lives like this?
Of course there could be. There's a million options.
And they've evolved beyond the primitive instincts that we have. And they truly are on a higher state of consciousness where they don't.
But, you know, this goes back to our philosophy episodes of good and evil. And like, can you have all good without bad? No. You have to have balance. Right. So
there is no heaven.
But maybe that's only for life as we know it and as humans. Yeah. Is there the potential that there is an alien race out there? Which, like, obviously we all believe aliens have to exist. It just wouldn't make sense any other way. And there's probably multiple civilizations. So there's a chance that one of those is so advanced that they're past all of that bullshit and that they really can live like this. I'm not trying to validate what Claude's saying here, obviously. He's just fucking wild. But I don't know. It's an interesting thought to have. Could there be such an evolved species out there that have it truly figured out?
You never know.
You never know.
You never know. Will we ever meet them, though?
I don't know. It's something I love. I love thinking about this, though. What it's like. I'm sure everyone does, right? Trying to picture what it'd be like on another alternate planet.
It would be nice. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure it didn't start that way.
Yeah.
I feel like there's...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, like evolution over time. Billions
well,
and billions
unfortunately,
of years,
here on Earth,
years.
I think we are a few
years
from reaching that point.
This is not possible for us anytime soon, or probably ever.
Well, one of the other ways that they have achieved this civilization is that the Elohim have no religion, only a belief in genius and science to accomplish all things.
Now, see, that personally makes a lot of sense to me.
Well, a lot of our issues stem from religion, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it would reduce a lot of conflict on the planet without religion. But that's a conversation for another day.
Yeah, definitely.
But the Elohim live from 750 to 1200 years. So a few more lifetimes than we do. And those meetings that Claude had with Yahweh concluded after the sixth day. And that was when Yahweh tasked Claude with spreading this message across Earth. He said he must shut down Autopop and dedicate everything to the mission of the Elohim. From Marie's perspective, quote, he set off one day to climb a mountain and came back as Rael. Claude immediately sought the media, telling reporters and radio stations that he had met one of these aliens piloting these UFOs everybody was seeing. He published his first book, The Book That Tells the Truth, in 1974, and was invited onto Jacques Chancel's show to recount this meeting he had. To those watching, though ridiculous, he seemed almost reluctant to have been given this mission. Those who watched thought his demeanor was humble, almost like, this happened to me. You can either choose to believe me or not.
That's a good interpretation, babe.
You like that?
Yes, I do. Following the Jacques Chancel appearance, Claude did another interview in which he announced a conference in Paris on September 19th, 1974. And people were interested. Some thought he was crazy and obviously just wanted to see the shit show and what else, you know, whatever came out of his mouth on stage. But most of these people were obsessed with UFOs and wanted to know more about the Elohim. And a few of these people actually believed every word. The first conference attracted over 2,000 people, again, according to the movement's website. And Claude stated the movement needed land so he could practice the teachings of the Elohim. So using the remaining funds from Autopop and membership fees from the first 12 members that he was able to gain, Claude bought a little house on some land in the Perigord region for the movement to begin truly. And they called this place Eden, of course. The movement's first name was Madek, which in English means Movement for Welcoming the Elohim, Creators of Humanity. And they began instituting the first of the movement's rituals. And this is where it really starts to get wild. All members performed the transmission of the cellular plan, which is basically the movement's version of like a baptism, before they could officially join. And the initiates must first sign an act of apostasy, abandoning their former church, and draft a will to pass on their assets to the movement. So just starting off with a bang. They also signed a contract with a local mortician to cut out a chunk of their frontal bone upon death to be packed in ice and stored in a vault for future collection by the Elohim.
Hell yeah, some cryogenics here.
Yeah. Then Claude, and eventually the other bishops within the movement, would rub water on their heads, any of the new members, to transmit their genetic code to the Elohim. Members state that they felt a connection to the planet of the Elohim during the transmission. And the members also began a group meditation, though it was more of a traditional version of meditation. And this would change very drastically very soon. While the movement started with 12 members, by the end of 1974, it grew to 170. And all of these people paid a small membership fee, and they were tasked with selling the book whenever they could. And while things were pretty simple for the group at this point, I mean, simple could be argued, but it just gets so much more wild from here. But Claude was still at this point not making much money. And of course, the messenger of the Elohim on Earth deserved luxury. So in the fall of 1975, a member invited Claude and Marie to his house for dinner. The member had recently purchased a comic book depicting all of the prophets having a meal together, and the member thought that Claude would get a kick out of it, but instead, an idea was hatched in Claude's head. And a few weeks later, Claude had his second encounter.
Okay, before we get to that, I have a question for you. Knowing what we just read, would you potentially go to the first meeting of this?
I mean, why not? Check it all out.
Does it sound enticing to you to some degree, just based off this?
Like to actually go and try to join it, or to just watch the shit show?
I think more so like see what it's about and see if it's something that you think would maybe resonate with you enough to follow along with.
I could see how someone would.
Yeah.
I'm personally like not in a place in my life where I'm looking for something like that. You know what
That's
I mean?
That's fair.
But I think even me now would go just to check it out, because it would be just interesting to observe what he's talking about. Mm-hmm. Would I actually take the time and go to something like this? Probably not, but...
Okay. What about you?
My 18-year-old self would. 100%.
Hey, and I would have gone with you back then, probably, for sure.
Okay, so when you say 18-year-old self, I'm assuming you mean because you newly left the church with your parents.
Yeah.
And I think back then, correct me if I'm wrong, you were, like, really looking for that, like, place of belonging and, like, who is Josh post this like Christian that you grew up as.
Absolutely.
And I feel like
I was on a soul searching mission.
Right.
God, Janelle, you know him so well.
Yeah.
It's almost like your family.
You just write a book for me.
You've listened to his stories all the years.
I have listened.
I've probably told you a lot over the years.
But I feel like there's so many people in those shoes
who
are longing for that community and that belonging. And maybe they've recently been, you know, either kicked out or have left some their family or the church or whatever it is, you know, and they're looking for that. I feel like this, and before you get like, before the things like, cause shit gets whack. I mean, let's all be real here. But this seems like, oh, maybe I could see myself becoming a part of this, you know?
Yeah, it's like an interesting new idea.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure to some people, like, oh, these things are all clicking, Noah's Ark, this and that.
Mm-hmm.
Especially for
ex-Christians. Yeah. Like, oh, well.
Yep.
He mentions Jesus and the Ark and whatever. Yeah.
Well, I think that's part of the design, too, is like he can get people who already have some of these beliefs instilled in them.
Right.
And then, you know, take them up a whole nother fucking level.
Well, it's when I think about it, it's really the freedom aspect of it, because a lot of religions are restrictive around your personal life choices and what you can and cannot do. So like for me, that was something that I quickly realized was such a great thing, was to not feel I was restricted by the teachings of my church or my parents, and I could go and make my own choices. And I think that's where cults really thrive, is they thrive on people who are kind of in this vulnerable soul searching state.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, if you look at any number of cults, you know, a lot, there's something there that resonates with the person.
Mm.
You know, it's usually not so wacky that everybody's going to be like, okay, this is ridiculous. Like, there's no way that this is beneficial to me whatsoever. All that stuff usually comes after they get you with a lot of really good, helpful information. I mean, if you look at all of the, you know, I was really into a lot of kind of the spiritual advisors. I watched a lot of people on YouTube. I really got into like Alan Watts.
Oh, I remember. And
I still listen to a lot of his lectures and and a lot of people kind of follow his teachings and his interpretations of Eastern religions and very, you know, spiritual teaching is different than somebody who's like, come join my group. But I think the number one thing that people really love about religion is that sense of community and fellowship. Mm-hmm. And so when you leave that and you're now, you know, almost all my friends were in the church.
Yeah.
And so leaving all that behind, there's kind of this sense of like, I'm on the outside now and I'm not allowed to be a part of their group anymore. And that's not the case for everybody, just my personal experience. I know there's a lot of Christians are like, oh, I have tons of non-Christian friends. And, you know, it really just depends. But for me, I could definitely see myself being like, oh, this is interesting. I also think Claude absolutely read a lot of literature. He definitely did some research and looked into some of the founding ideas around aliens. And there's a lot of things he pulled from elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I can think of a number of different kind of alien stories and thinking to the story of Roswell. And I'm sure he was kind of familiar with some of, you know, panspermia, the idea that, you know, alien DNA or extraterrestrial DNA started life here on Earth, not necessarily by a being landing on the planet or
from a comet, right? Or an asteroid.
Yeah, traveling here on some piece of space debris or asteroid or something like that.
It's actually a really interesting theory. I find that one.
Yeah, I believe we have an episode out there from the past about all of the different theories around how life started on this Earth. Claude's is not in that one. So, but I think he took a lot of very interesting ideas that people, and if you think about the time period too, I mean, we're talking about the 1970s, there was a lot of this like new thought movement. There's like a lot of these new ideals coming about. And so people were kind of in this new kind of open-minded place, and they're open to kind of these out there ideas that are kind of against the social norms at the time. So I think he also hit the timing perfectly when he started this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of this perfect storm for him, and that culminating with all the UFO stuff. And, you know, he's kind of this, it's kind of like this hippie-ish type, you know, we love everybody, you know, we are one is a big thing that he says a lot.
Reminds me a lot of L. Ron Hubbard too, the way he mixes and matches from other things. And then he had kind of hit a little bit of a different time, but same kind of idea, I think.
But it all starts with personal growth.
Yeah.
And like, I have a proprietary method for improving your life.
Yep.
You have to follow me and pay me money.
Of course, to
get the secrets to, you know, how I have achieved, you know, this enlightenment and connection with our creators, basically. So it's nothing new, really. He didn't like create anything really original. I feel like his story is very,
very borrowed. Feels like we've heard this one before.
Ever tried to break a bad habit and feel like you're climbing Mount Everest with flip-flops on? Yeah, we've been there too. But here's a breath of fresh air, Fume. It's not about giving up, it's about switching up. Fume takes your habit and simply makes it better, healthier, and a whole lot more enjoyable. If you've never heard of Fume before, it's a really cool, innovative, award-winning flavored air device that does just that. Instead of vapor, Fume uses flavored air. Instead of electronics, Fume is completely natural. And instead of harmful chemicals, Fume uses delicious flavors. Fume is a good habit you're free to enjoy and makes replacing your bad habit easy. Your Fume comes with an adjustable airflow dial and is designed with movable parts and magnets for fidgeting, giving your fingers a lot to do, which is helpful for de-stressing and anxiety while breaking your habit. Fume is honestly a cool device. I love the build quality of it. It's made out of solid wood and metal, so it feels really nice and premium in your hand. It probably will last many, many years, but they have some really cool flavor pods as well, including raspberry lemon, white cranberry, orange vanilla, maple pepper, and my favorite, crisp mint. It's super easy to set up. Again, it's nice, you don't have to charge it or anything like that, and you can take it anywhere. Start the year off right with a good habit by going to tryfume.com/milehigher and getting the journey pack today. Fume is giving our listeners of the show 10% off when they use our code milehigher. to help make starting the good habit that much easier.
But let's get back to our story here. So Claude had a second encounter, and on October 7th, 1975, he gathered up all his members for an important announcement. Not only had the Elohim met with him again, but this time they took him to their planet. Yahweh once again met with Rael in his spacecraft before flying at light speed to the planet of Eternals. This planet, which was separate from the Elohim's home planet, was designed for humans and prophets from Earth to reside on forever. Humans who proved themselves worthy on Earth would be granted eternal life through cloning. They lived alongside 700 Elohim, the Council of Eternals. And what's more, Yahweh was the prime minister. And Claude said that the background music on this planet faded when they spoke and got louder when they didn't. So some really advanced speakers there. Yahweh introduced Claude to the great prophets at a mass table within one of the futuristic buildings, and they ate a meal together prepared by the robots, who had done all the work, of course. Speaking to Claude, Yahweh said that after the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of World War II, humanity had entered an age of the apocalypse and needed to embrace their scientific achievements and practice life like the Elohim do. Cloning was the most important of all human endeavors, and humans were to clone themselves to achieve eternal life, just like the Elohim. When one clone dies, your genetic information is uploaded to a new one. And actually, friends, didn't know if you know this, but Jesus rose from the dead after the Elohim downloaded his information into a new clone within his tomb.
Happy Easter.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, perfect timing.
I guess this will be up quite late after Easter.
But oh, for us.
Just passed for us.
Happy Easter. If you're curious about the true Easter story.
There you go.
There it is.
That's how he is risen.
So anyway. What'd they do with his other body?
They
just cloned him and then just extracted the other original body.
I don't know if he gave Claude that detail. Unfortunate. Sensual meditation was to become central to the rituals of Claude's movement. And the Elohim were constantly exploring new areas of sexual experience with one another, and humanity was to follow suit. The Earth was to construct an embassy for the Elohim by 2035 so that they could finally give their teachings to us. And Claude was to prepare the world for their arrival. So no easy task for him. And he's got to build this huge embassy. I mean, this thing was supposed to be massive. And finally, Yahweh revealed the truth to Claude about his own past. Turns out, on Christmas 1945, Yahweh took Claude's mother, Colette, aboard his ship, and Yahweh impregnated her and then wiped her memory, meaning Yahweh was Claude's actual father. Sounds familiar, right? He had done the same thing to Mother Mary. Jesus was Claude's brother, in fact.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, they're bros. Once, a journalist asked Colette if she knew if an alien impregnated her, and she said, and this is in a sarcastic way, "Who knows? I sleep with the window open during the summertime."
Dude, I sleep with the window open year-round, so.
Do you really?
Yeah. It gets hot in my room.
Look now out for Yahweh.
Yeah, I might have to close that shit.
Yeah, seriously. I think she's confused, though. Why did she say the summertime? They're talking about Christmas. I don't know.
I don't know, man.
Anyway, before the Elohim returned Claude to Earth, Yahweh gave him one last message. Claude was their final prophet, and he was to dedicate his life to making the world welcome them. He was given the name Rael, meaning messenger, and sent on his way back to Earth. So Claude, who is now Rael, reintroduced himself to his followers and announced the group's new name, which of course was Raelism. Now, many members, including the man who had shown Rael that comic with the dinner scene, whatever, thought that this encounter was too crazy, and he left the movement. I mean, the story of the encounter. However, the ones who stayed were passionate in their belief that Rael was the Messiah. Now, before we go any further, I do want to issue a little bit of a trigger warning. It has been pretty funny up until this point, and there are still some LOLs here to go, but there's also a lot of really disturbing moments as we move forward.
It seems like after he had this second encounter, he reemerges as the Messiah, And he does everything a messiah wouldn't do by exploiting the power and control he has now ordained upon himself based on this encounter he had, and just takes everything to a whole nother level in the wrong direction. So yeah, things definitely take a turn after he meets up with Yahweh a second time.
To be specific, we are going to be talking about pedophilia. So I think it's important to just make that really clear.
Yeah,
this could definitely be really upsetting for some. It was to learn about. So
Rael at this point is on a mission to get the word out about Raelism and the Raelian movement, and he does a bunch of news interviews, and the media loves him. I mean, if you are listening, this guy, he just looks exactly like you would think he looks. He's got kind of crazy hair. He's like balding on his head. He's got kind of poofy hair come out of the side. And he wears all white,
mm-hmm.
and he wears a big chain with his Raelism symbol on his chest everywhere he goes. And at this point, you know, the media loves him because he's just kind of like, he brings in the ratings. I mean, he's got mm-hmm. that kind of shock factor, and
great
people
for
are
TV.
Obviously interested in hearing what this guy is all about. And so new members were joining in absolute droves, enticed by the stories of aliens and this sexual freedom that Rael endorsed. Sensual meditation became a common ritual for the Raelians in a group setting. Raelians removed their clothes and began to focus, and once they were centered, they were to examine their bodies, looking at and touching every part. One of the stranger elements, honestly very disturbing elements, is that Rael instructed them to look at their buttholes with a mirror. Or the scientific term, anus, if you're curious.
Yeah.
Which I have no idea why or what about this is important, but...
It's your third eye.
Oh my God. Yeah, and it's clearly just like a sick fetish. It's honestly really fucking scary to think about. They're all together doing this too. Like, I just keep... I don't know why this image just will not leave my brain.
Dude,
of them all
same.
Like laying on the floor, cheeks spread, mirrors. So like imagine
Ew.
Looking
yeah.
around from that angle.
This is like part of the meditation ritual.
Yeah.
So after they do this,
disturbing.
The members all pick a partner, touch each other's bodies, and then proceed to have sex. Polyamory was now central to the Raelian movement. If you were married, your partner was to be shared with everyone else. Rael said that jealousy comes from someone who is not fulfilled. However, the man himself was intensely jealous. Marie was kept in the house and no one was to sleep with her, but Rael would sleep with whoever he wanted, and early on he would manipulate members to keep them away from his favorites. By the end of the 1970s, Rael had slept with hundreds of women. He would bring them into the house and make Marie clean up after.
That is so fucked up.
God. And even if she walked into the room, Rael would not stop having sex with whatever woman was with him at the time. It was around this time that he also published Aliens Took Me to Their Planet, another book, in 1979, as well as Sensual Meditation in 1980. And the books not only outlined the Elohim teachings of sexual exploration, but also Rael's very strange views on sexual education for children, which we'll talk about this in depth later. But it seemed that Rael and other high-ranking officials were interested in the younger members of their growing cult. As the movement grew, there was a new formation. There was Rael at the top, and his word was law. Underneath him were bishops, priests, and meditation guides. These members were often chosen for their convictions or financial contributions. The benefit would be one-on-one sensual meditations with whichever member they chose, which, again, would almost always end in sex. Rael didn't have to go through the ritual, though, of course. If Rael picked a member, that member had to have sex with him almost immediately. If a member also became intimate with a woman Rael had chosen, that member would either be demoted, kicked out, or promoted if they agreed to stay away from her. In 1978, the mass death of the Jim Jones cult brought public fear and scrutiny to new religious movements at large, and the French government began to look into this bizarre alien cult in so-called Eden. Although Rael had slept with hundreds of women, all of whom paid a small fee like the other members, Rael needed a way to make more money. Then, luckily, he got a telepathic message from the Elohim. He was to begin work immediately on the embassy's construction.
Do you think it was always his goal to be this creepy, like, sexual dude?
100%.
Yeah, I think so, too.
You look at his childhood and the rejection by female. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
I think it was, like, always deep down in him. He may not have started it with that as his intent. He could have. He certainly could have. But I think he possibly saw more of an opportunity to make it exactly what he wanted over time. Yeah.
Rael also announced to the group, which was now close to 300 in total numbers, that their central mission was to construct this embassy. He also began to refer to himself as the Messiah openly, which is always concerning, and his members were to refer to him as such. In the beginning, Rael wore regular clothes and grew his beard out. While he was the leader, members saw him as a peer rather than a god. So he was like, I got to change that. And like that description of him I was just giving you, he started to wear all white. He styled his hair insanely in a lot of weird ways, and he'd have other members speak for him and begin to exercise financial control over every single member. A member by the name of Pierre Gary, Aurelian since 1974, came from a wealthy Belgian family and was one of the officials in charge of the embassy's construction. He felt like the religion became an action movement, something concrete to work for. The aliens were flesh and bone too, so of course, they wanted to have a table for them when they finally arrived. And they took action. Rael and Gary announced that the embassy would cost 160 million francs, and the small membership fee was just not gonna cut it. So, members of Raelism were forced to contribute at least 10% of their annual salary to the construction of the embassy, and an additional 1% going straight to Rael himself. Of course, you could contribute more, and the top 10 contributors would be celebrated at the end of the year and promoted to one of the higher levels. Sounds like another cult out there that we've talked about quite a bit. Scientology.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
very
the
similar.
Financial contributors, you know,
well, I mean,
make their way to the top.
Religions, too. We've talked a lot, not maybe all religions, but it reminds me, too, of televangelism and our discussion around that and just the pressure to tithe. Is that what it's called?
Yes.
Tithe, yeah. And I mean, 10% of your salary, that is a lot.
Yeah, that's a ton of money.
God, and some of these people at this point were like, I can't do this, and like totally freaking out. I think some of them bailed at this point too. But for
yeah,
the most
priced
part,
a lot of members out, which was probably on purpose so that he could then, you know, figure out who the real ones were and then replace them with more. Mm-hmm. Kind of make it more of an elite club in a way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that he openly was like, 1% will be going to me.
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't get paid by the nonprofit, so.
Yeah. Well, oftentimes you hear with tithings and, you know, some religious leaders that they hide that part of it. Like, yes, they're taking a percentage, but it's, you know, it's, you're funding my private jet so that I can spread the word.
I was about to say,
and it's just.
Who said God wants me to fly in a private jet? Was that Kenneth?
I think that was Dollar.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It was him.
What was his name?
I forgot his fucking name.
Something Dollar.
You don't.
Well, it's like a lot of times they're like, you know, I'm representing God, so I want to look good and, you know, look like.
Give me the finest alligator boots money can buy.
Yeah, I mean, they want to project this image. Mm-hmm. You know, are people going to want to come hear advice from a guy wearing like thrift clothes and tattered rags?
Which is what Jesus would do, right?
Yeah, although that's, if you want to look at the Bible again, that's exactly what Jesus was a very humble dude. He wasn't dripping in gold.
Well, Claude was like, I'm going to openly drip in gold and you guys are going to pay for it. 1% of all of this money is going to go towards me. Mm-hmm. So at least you got to give it to him for being, not trying to hide it like all these other people do, but it's so fucked. I feel so bad for these people. I don't know how you end up at this point in your life when that is just such a massive thing to ask of people. 10% of their salaries.
Yeah, it's definitely a bit much.
Mm-hmm.
So at first, Rael said the embassy had to be built in Israel so the prophets would return to a familiar place on earth. Shockingly, the Israeli government never responded to his request. But luckily and conveniently, the Elohim communicated a new message to Rael. They said, oh, Israel said, no, no problem. You can just build it anywhere on earth. So it's just convenient how the messages kind of line up with what's actually happening in reality and what's best for Rael. But not only did Rael have control over members' sex lives, he now had control over their financial security too. He claims that he doesn't touch the money reserved for the embassy, but his lifestyle would disagree. This dude, like we said, is dripping. He's got expensive cars. He's got properties. He's got gambling benders. And he even got back into race car driving, nicknaming himself the fastest prophet in the world. So he's like, as soon as he could get back into his true passion, he was like, oh, yeah, definitely need to be the fastest prophet.
So it's clear he's taken more than that 1%, right?
Yeah. I don't even think we really know the actual financial structure of the organization.
Taking all of it.
Or who had access to the accounts and controlled the money. Mm-hmm. So these races that he took part in cost $20,000 per competition, and his members had to fund it. There's a delightful picture of him in his little race car. Looks pretty nice. Almost looks like a Lambo or something.
It's crazy.
Rial on the door.
Yeah.
And his suit, outfit. Outfits that he wears every day, especially now, are like modeled after the like one-piece race car suit.
Yeah. Yep.
He's got his little man bun.
It was interesting. There was an interview with an ex-member. I believe she's an ex-member, but she was talking about how she was like pretty game to, she felt like, you know, overwhelmed giving 10% of her salary as it is. But then when they were asked to fund these races, she just couldn't, she was like trying to understand why that was important, but just felt like at the end of the day, she was paying for him to go play with cars.
Well, in his mind, he's thinking this is just getting the word out, right?
Yeah.
You know, the more public attention I can get, the better for the organization, the more money for the organization.
Right.
So it's like, he's like, oh, it's just marketing costs. It's just cost to...
Do you support the movement growing or not?
Yeah, he could have done. He could have just done the Mormon approach, the door-to-door approach.
No, race cars.
But he was like, no, let's get a fancy Lambo, throw Rael on the side of it, and I'll drive it, baby.
It's really interesting to see how pretty much all of his childhood makes so much sense, and who he was from such a young person, this starving for attention, the race car thing. It's not shocking to see that he ended up here.
Oh, and anytime he walks into a room, he's like, he's like,
he eats it up.
Oh, yeah, he loves it. You can just tell his ego is so, so big. I mean, he's just like soaking it all in. He loves it. He's like, this is amazing.
Mm-hmm. And they love him.
In his mind, he's living the dream.
Yeah.
Living the dream.
And these people, man, they were into it. They were fully, they bought the whole thing. I mean, the way that when he walks in a room, they're just like moved. I mean, some of the people, you know, we listened to interviews from, they were just like, to be in the presence of him, to look into his eyes.
He's Jesus's brother, dude. Like, how could you not?
I mean, if you really believe this guy is the Messiah,
God, it's so
sad to me. That's how you're going
to
act.
How do you end up at that point in life where this,
he's filling a void for people.
How does this happen?
Yeah. Well, the media drummed up by the embassy announcement brought in new members, richer and more successful ones.
Perfect.
Brigitte Boisselier joined with her husband and children around this time, and she was a successful French biochemist who had become the second most important person within the Raelian movement. And what's interesting about the Raelian movement is that many scientists joined. And that is very, very peculiar.
Yeah.
Such smart individuals academically.
I know.
Would sign on with this.
Yeah, it's hard to wrap your mind around.
Well, they saw Rael's vision of the Raelian planet as a blueprint for Earth and thought they could achieve this scientific utopia through Rael's guidance. Because I think the whole message of like, this is based around science, like everything can be explained by science, probably registers with a lot of scientists, because a lot of scientists do believe, you know, their belief systems are often kind of along that line of thinking.
Yeah.
So it kind of makes sense. But on the major downside, Rael also attracted a whole new group of members as well. Pedophiles. His book, Sensual Meditation, laid out the framework for the group's meditative practices and highlighted Rael's views on sexual education for children. Part of the book reads, quote, "You will awaken the mind of your child, but you will also awaken his or her body. For the awakening of the body is linked to the awakening of the mind. Rael encouraged parents to instruct their children on how to masturbate, often by showing them."
It's disgusting.
Patrick Lauriat, who is an ex-third level meditation guide, wrote an article about how Rael encouraged sexual contact with parents and their children. He said, quote, "I had to come to consider as normal to make love with my children when they were formed. By dint of caressing them, as recommended by Rael, I could not feel the moral barriers imposed by society anymore. It was not until I left the cult to accept that my behavior was that of a depraved person and to finally succeed in making me feel guilty about it. Whew.
That's heavy stuff.
Sickening. Absolutely sickening. But Rael didn't limit sexual contact with minors to just their parents. As any member of the movement could instruct children on how to feel pleasure, according to Rael, quote, "We must recognize that adolescents have the right to their own sexual lives, a freedom enabled by today's contraceptives, and we must remove laws that criminalize sexual activities between someone over the age of 18 and someone under that age." So he's like, pedophilia should be legal.
Yep. Yeah. So things are getting real dark here.
The sexual sadistic side, really, of him is is starting to come at, really come through. And
I'd say it's like fully.
It's completely overshadowing any of the good things at this point, because it seems very obvious that the sexual part of it for him is the driving force at this point.
And we're sort of getting ahead of ourselves here, but the Raelian movement has been surrounded by allegations of pedophilia ever since. In the early 2000s, Rael married his second wife, Sophie, who was 16 years old. Of course, Rael didn't need to marry, as he could have sex with any member of the movement, but he did this for a legal reason. He could avoid child crime laws if he was married to the minor. He also gave this advice to others in the Raelian movement, saying, quote, "I myself married Sophie when she was 16, and then we divorced once she was an adult." And divorce they did. According to ex-Raelian Mary Helene Parent, who was one of Rael's favorite girls, when Sophie turned 27 or 28, he tasked an assistant with finding him a new wife who could be no more than 15 years old. So this is a real sick motherfucker we're talking about. But in the early 90s, Rael was able to keep his pedophilic activities a secret from the general public. And to Rael, he was living the dream. He was wealthy. He went on talk shows to drive ratings. He raced cars. He boasted in the public about how many thousands of women he had slept with. But then in 1992, an ex-Raelian, Jean Paraga, showed up at Eden with a gun, intending to kill Rael. Jean and his wife joined the Raelian movement with their children in the mid-1980s. Jean owned a repair shop, but was also a drug runner and a car smuggler between France and Algiers. He was put in jail for attempting to bring a Mercedes stuffed with hashish back to France. He was released in 1992 and returned to Eden, only to find that his wife and children had moved in with a Raelian priest. Additionally, one of his children had tragically died after swimming in a pool on the compound, and the others were being preyed on by Raelian members. So obviously, he was pretty fucking pissed off, and the assassination attempt on Rael didn't actually go anywhere, as the Raelians now had armed guards watching the property. But then Jean approached Christophe Deschavin, who was the host of popular talk show Cell Montmartre, and told his story. Now, Christophe had had Rael on the show numerous times before, normally with a like humorous intent, but now Christophe planned to confront Rael about the crimes against children that took place on his compound. Unfortunately, the interview is entirely in French with no translation, but it began with Christophe asking Rael point blank if they had any sexual relations with children in the cults. And Rael answered, quote, "Mostly, but freedom in all aspects." And this shocked Christophe. I mean, how could someone just so openly admit to committing and encouraging pedophilia? Then Christophe brought out Jean, who told the audience that Rael not only encouraged him to have sex with his 6 and 8-year-old children, but Rael wanted to as well. And the tensions really rose on the program. Jean said that Rael was keeping his wife and children hostage and forcing his wife to have sex with other men. Rael responded by saying, quote, "She's not with you because she doesn't want to be." Jean tried to fight Rael's minion in the middle of the recording. There's a lot of it in, I think, in the Netflix. Or is that in the Vice documentary?
No, in the Netflix.
On the Netflix, yeah.
Yeah, they have the full shebang where you can see
again,
them almost get into it here. Mm-hmm.
So Raelians believe this interview was a trap, of course, and some members actually cried when questioned about it. Now, the entire country knew the truth about the Raelians. The French government, who had watched the Raelians, now had legal action to pursue. So things were not looking so hot for them. And a few months later, in 1992, five Raelian men were charged with rape and molestation of an 11-year-old girl. The victim was a child of a Raelian mother who not only knew about the molestation taking place, but actually encouraged these men to have sex with her daughter as part of her sexual education. Just beyond upsetting and disturbing. And the rape charge was dropped because at that time, legally, it was an act that could only occur between people over the age of 15. But the men were convicted of molestation and corruption of minors. Rael didn't believe this was rape, though. He thought that the young girl had consented, which, of course, is impossible. Things started to go really downhill for Raelism at this point. The French government labeled the Raelian movement a dangerous cult, removed their tax-exempt status, so really hit them below the belt there, and then monitored Eden as well. Locals would actually shoot at the compound and attack the Raelians, and hundreds of members lost their jobs. In France, Rael had now been labeled the leader of a perverse cult. But more importantly, he couldn't make money if the people on the compound didn't have jobs. So his wife Marie, the one who had left him back in 1985, saw Rael as a freak, but their children were still in the movement and she wanted to do anything to bring them back. So instead of facing up to his crimes or giving his children back to Marie to be safe, Rael took the rest of the cult's money and bought a compound in Quebec, Canada. And he took the kids and whatever members could afford the move and fled France.
So in 1995, the Raelian cult relocated to Neuville, a rural village in Quebec. Hundreds of followers met Rael at the airport and 300 members lived with him on the compound. The new members were even more devoted and structured than before. Most importantly, they gave even more money to Rael. Rael announced that before constructing an embassy, they should build a museum of UFOs and Elohim history on the compound and call it UFO Land. He planned to have it rival Disneyland with rides and experiments to document his encounters with the Elohim. But theme parks are expensive, and between Rael's race cars, gambling habit, costly dinners, and saving money for the all-important and totally real embassy, there wasn't much left over for this UFO Land. So what they did is they constructed a massive flying saucer within one of the compound's barns with a staircase you could use to board the craft. But you couldn't take any pictures once inside. Otherwise, inside of this thing is so pathetic. It's just completely empty except for a few inflatable chairs. They also displayed a scale model of the embassy and large posters detailing Rael's talks with aliens and their beliefs. UFO Land was less of a theme park and more of a recruitment center. For what it was, UFO Land was a massive success, and once again, media from across the country descended on Rael's compound to figure out what these alien believers were all about. The locals were friendly, as they didn't know about the pedophilia or the court cases that surrounded the cult in France. In Canada, Rael once again felt free, and that meant getting as much attention as possible. Rael wanted the world to recognize him at the same level as the Pope, with millions worldwide respecting him as a great religious leader. And then in 1997, takes us to the cloning achievement of Dolly the sheep, which was the first mammal successfully cloned from an adult sheep. Pope John Paul II made a speech where he stated that cloning was a sin and that humans should not have the ability to play God. Rael saw this statement and said the opposite, since he wanted to be the anti-pope, and the Raelians were going to be the first to one-up it and clone a human child. And this is where we run into some contradictions. Rael states that cloning had always been central to the Elohim's mission on Earth, but ex-members pointed to older editions of his previous books where cloning is even mentioned, and that the Elohim could simply heal injury and disease, so there was no need for cloning. They maintain that Rael didn't consider cloning until Dolly and the Pope made that statement. Regardless, the cloning thing became his new obsession. Only a few weeks after Dolly was cloned, Rael created CloneAid, a research division focused solely on human cloning. Brigitte Boisselier, who followed Rael to Quebec, but left her spouse and youngest daughter in France, was to head all research for this new project. Damien Marsic, another French biochemist who followed Rael, was her only research partner. Brigitte and Rael did a massive media blitz talking to anyone in the US and Canada that they possibly could. This is crazy, but he was actually featured on CNN, NBC, Fox, and many Canadian news organizations. And none of them questioned Rael or Brigitte about the crimes against children the cult had been convicted of in France. All they wanted to talk about with them was cloning.
Hey, that's the media for you. Not surprising at all.
So let's take a look at a few clips that we found about human cloning.
Bushman saying this is so bad and all these things. I said, I have to do it and show that this is only a baby. A little baby, the belated twin of an individual, and that's it. It's not a monster. It's not all, you know, what we have been hearing so many bad things about this baby. And so we decided to do that 4 years ago. Now we are on the verge to have this first embryo.
And when do you suspect it will happen?
I don't want to be rushed into saying a date. What I'm saying is that we are in the process of doing it. We will check every possible defects before, so we'll need to make sure that the embryo is completely viable and before doing any implantation. So the soonest we could have an implantation is mid-April. It could be in a year from now because we want to make sure that this baby is completely and perfectly healthy.
So obviously in that clip, you can kind of just get an idea of who Brigitte is. And she, again, is a very respected, before all this, biochemist, highly regarded in her field. And I think that her reputation is a major reason why she got the interviews that she did. But she's just wholly lying in this interview about what's actually happening behind the scenes and that they're doing this and that.
And she is committed to the lie. I mean, she's still lying today. It's crazy. Yeah, it was interesting to see she was on Anderson Cooper 360 too. It's just like, it's so fucking wild. They were also on, well, they weren't. They
did a sketch on
SNL on Weekly Update with Tina Fey back when it was actually good, Tina Fey and Amy Poehler. And they had them, you know, someone dressed up as the two of them.
As and then
they
actually had their
baby Eve clone come in the background. And yeah, I mean, they were eating it up, man. Any exposure is good exposure, right? Which Eve will explain more, but I'm sure you could probably guess the first cloned baby. We'll get into it. So one of the people to see Rael on TV was American lawyer Mark Hunt, and he was very intrigued by what Rael and Brigitte were saying, and he ended up reaching out to Brigitte. His 10-month-old child had just actually died under doctor's care, and he said that he would personally fund Clonaid's research endeavor if they could bring his son back to life. And unsurprisingly, Brigitte and Rael told him that with absolute certainty that they would, in fact, clone his child. Brigitte and Damien moved to Nitro, West Virginia, where the lab was based, and began work. And by work, what we really mean is Damien did the work. Brigitte flew across the U.S. for news conferences, interviews, and speaking engagements, and she was only in the lab once for a photo shoot, of course. And they talked about how she like didn't even know how to use a microscope, was just totally clueless and just basically posing for pictures. In reality, Rael had purchased homes in Las Vegas and Miami where she would mainly live and travel to whichever one Rael was staying at. Vegas for the gambling and Miami for the women. They also took money from others who wished to clone their loved ones, $200,000 per clone. Again, Damien was the sole person working on this milestone in human technology. Brigitte also handpicked 50 young Raelian women as potential surrogate mothers for the human clones. One of them was her own daughter, 22-year-old Marina. And Brigitte also still had an 8-year-old living in France with her former spouse, Gilles Carbonell, who were still involved in Raelian communes. Brigitte and Rael had created enough of a media whirlwind through the announcement that in 2001, Congress actually invited Brigitte to testify before a House subcommittee. And despite knowing nothing about cloning or science in general, Rael asked if he could also testify. Of course, I mean, any chance he can to get that spotlight. And let's watch a clip of that, shall we?
Human cloning will make it possible for us to reach eternal life. It is the right of the people who want to enjoy the fruit of scientific progress including human cloning and eternal life, to benefit from it. If religion and superstition, which are the same, had power over science, we would still be living in the dark age. Your great constitution includes the freedom of religion, and that means also the freedom to be atheist, freedom to believe that there is no God, and benefit from science without any moral restriction. We Raelians believe that science should be our religion, as science saves lives while religion and superstition kill. Science destroys superstition and supernatural belief. That's why religion was always an enemy of science and progress, and is again trying to stop science at its best. It should be the freedom of the people to decide if they want to benefit or not from human cloning. Legalizing human cloning is protecting the right of the unreborn, as cloning makes it possible a second chance to live for infant, like the one cloned planned to clone now, a 10-month-old baby killed by medical malpractice. It could be your own beloved child or grandchild. Think about him personally. Lawmakers should not be accomplices of dark age power and superstition, as they will be judged by history. Human cloning is the first step toward another great discovery, the creation of totally artificial form of life, like that was done by our creators, the Elohim, when they did created us on Earth. Not only human cloning is not against the wish of what people call God, but it is our creator's plan to have us discover and use it, as many other religious leaders claim, becoming, as it is written in the Bible, equal to our creators.
Oh my God, I can't believe that actually happened.
What are your guys' thoughts on cloning?
I don't know. It's a controversial subject because I know there could be a lot of like life-saving.
Like cloning to harvest.
Yeah.
Body parts from.
I think like a full-on, the whole thing weirds me.
Well, I think it comes down to, I think in order for cloning to really be viable, we have to understand the nature of consciousness. We have to understand where consciousness originates from, because if you clone a human, is that human just going to be a shell, so to speak,
right,
of yourself? Or is that human going to also have a consciousness enter it? That, like, we can't clone consciousness, right? Like, we can probably clone the human body. Science does believe that that's possible. But how would you clone consciousness, right?
Like,
I couldn't just copy my, maybe with Neuralink or something where you could download your, you know, if we could figure out how to download our consciousness and then transfer it to another
body. Elohim, the water on the head. Yeah.
But I think that's what it comes down to, is like, I don't know how, like, what would be the benefit of it other than just creating more people? Because would your clone have the same consciousness as you?
No, that's a good point. And I know when it comes to people like cloning their pets, it's not the same personality as your pet was before. They may look pretty identical, but.
Right. It seems like a new consciousness enters that body.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's say cloning exists, and when you do it, yes, your consciousness is the same, your soul is the same. What are you for it?
I'm still against it. That's just my own personal belief, I guess, because I feel that
it's one and done.
Yeah, and I feel like we're designed to be that way, and it's just fucking with the way things are or should be. That's just how I see it. I don't know. It feels wrong to me. I think you're meant, it's a one-time thing. One go around the sun.
One time in this body.
Yes. Yeah.
And that the soul moves on.
If we really want to get into it, I do believe that I'm a believer in reincarnation for the most part. That's like what's most appealing to me belief-wise. So I do believe but I don't think it's something that we should be part of that process, you know?
So it is, cloning is kind of playing God in a way.
Yes. And that's where it's too much. Too much. Hmm. What do you think?
I don't know. I don't know what I think, honestly. I can see the argument for both. I think I would like to be the only unique version of myself that exists on this planet, and that there isn't another version of me. But if there is a way for me to have a clone transfer me, my consciousness, into that clone and live forever, that could be kind of cool.
Oh, you really? I don't want there. Nothing is
There's no appeal to me towards living forever or being immortal or anything.
Well, according to the Bible, people lived like hundreds and hundreds of years in the past. So our lifespan has decreased over time.
Yeah,
if we were able to increase our time here on Earth, I kind of would like to stick around and see what the Earth looks like in 500 years.
Oh,
honestly.
I'm good on that. I don't need to see.
Kind of want to see what life's like.
No. I don't know. I feel like most of the older people that I, you know, towards the end of their life, they were like pretty ready to just be done with this place. I don't know. What do you think, Janelle?
I think parts of the idea of cloning is appealing to me, mostly because my biggest fear in the world is death, which I know like a lot of people's is, but it's like a phobia of mine almost. Like I'm so terrified of the thought of the finality of death. And so part of me, I think, like the thought of, oh, well, if I could bring a loved one back, then it would, you know, in theory, like, oh, they don't go away then. And that's great. But like, I don't know if that's like really the right reason to use that. You know what I mean?
And do you feel like you could ever really reconnect and things would be the same? Like, let's imagine
probably
our grandfather
not.
Was cloned and he's back and all of a sudden we have him again.
No, probably not. Feel like logically, probably not.
Be
in
like,
my like anxiety
Grandy.
Mind, I'm like, yeah, that sounds good. Grandy cloned so I don't have to like deal with the loss. Great. But like, if you think a little more logically about cloning,
mm-hmm.
probably not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it seems like the circle of life must include death.
That's how I feel.
Everything must die.
I don't think you complete your evolution of a human, you know, or your journey, really, I guess I should say, your spiritual exploration until you die.
Death is just another path.
That's right. We all must
one
take.
One that we all must take.
That's right.
Who a said wise that? Man once said that.
That was Gandalf, right?
Yes.
All right. The House subcommittee decided, after hearing Rael discuss humanity's creation by the Elohim, to ban cloning across the country. And President George W. Bush supported this measure and even addressed it during his State of the Union. Pretty wild time. The FBI raided Clonaid Lab, and members who resided in the U.S. had law enforcement search their homes for evidence of cloning. Brigitte lost her actual job as a biochemist, and custody of her 8-year-old daughter was taken away from her. Which was definitely good. But she said that this only further encouraged her to create the first human clone because she wanted her daughter to see what she'd accomplished and be with her again. In reality, though, custody was stripped from her when her former spouse, Gilles Carbonell, was arrested after he sexually assaulted her daughter when she was 6. He was the president of the Raelian Association, Île-de-France, and was last reported missing. Although work on Clonaid had seemingly screeched to a halt, Rael had other projects to keep him busy. In 1998, he created Rael's Angels, an order of the most attractive women in the movement. During a transmission from the Elohim, the aliens told Rael that only beautiful women were to be allowed within the embassy to satisfy the Elohim sexually. And the application process was simple, ladies. Women sent in a photo, and if they were beautiful enough, he would have sex with them. If they were good enough in bed, they joined the angels. And the angels became an important media element to the Raelian movement because they even posed, forget this, they posed for Playboy with Rael in the center. He's actually in the pictures. And they also awarded Hugh Hefner the Raelian Humanitarian Award. So pretty amazing. I think we have pictures of it. I mean, ones that are somewhat appropriate to put on YouTube. We'll try. No promises, but you can obviously look them up yourself. But of course, the angels had a tier system too. Angels who wore white feathers were allowed to have sex with the Elohim, Rael, and any other member of the cult. But those who wore pink feathers, Rael's favorites, could only be intimate with Rael, of course, and the Elohim. He would share them with them at least. But they could never say no. Very dark to think about. Rael also created Rael's Girls, which was a group of sex workers within the movement who would advocate for the rights of those within the sex industry. And this sounds good on paper, but they were made in conjunction with the No Pedo, Rael's other organization that condemned pedophilia in the Catholic Church, and he had planned to use his girls to re-educate pedophile priests through sex. So, I don't even know how to explain that. It makes absolutely no sense. And this is also when Rael married Sophie, his 16-year-old wife, who was the head of Rael's Angels. Her mother was a Raelian, and Sophie was born into the cult. So sad to think about. Some people can just be born into this type of fucked up world.
I know, God.
Her mother and Rael essentially groomed her to become the prophet's wife. And Rael also thought this would be an excellent time to release videos and pamphlets on what he viewed sex education should be for young children. Now, this is so, I don't even know how to explain this. We are not going to play this video. However, it is available on YouTube to this day.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm like, wow, YouTube, you don't let tons of shit fly, but you'll keep this up.
Yep. Yep.
Comments
They're
are
shutting us down constantly.
Comments are disabled though.
Oh, like, okay.
Oh, could have seen that coming.
Or maybe the Raelians disabled. Or
yeah.
The,
they did.
Yes.
That's their channel.
Yeah. So they turned off the comment.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were saying YouTube.
No, because they don't want people being on there like, what the fuck is this pedophilic shit?
It's so creepy. It's
creepy,
like this,
you guys.
This bunny character talking about sexual freedom for children, and like, it's disturbing. I'm not going to explain it any more than that. But yeah, it's pretty fucking bizarre, and I cannot believe it is on YouTube. That's absolutely insane.
After the angels were created, Rael married a child, and the cloning debacle led to CloneAid being shut down. Many Raelians saw Rael for what he was indeed, a sex-obsessed maniac who is addicted to female submission. His children, fully grown adults at this point, finally left the cult and resumed contact with their mother, Marie. Rael's Aunt Therese was interviewed during the clone debacle and said that his mother, Colette, thought that she had, quote, raised a monster. Colette also gave her last interview saying from behind her front door, quote, what he is doing now is vile. I have not seen him for 10 years, and I'll be happy if I never see him again. As always, though, the members who stayed only grew more loyal to him. After Rael testified before Congress, a Canadian newspaper sent reporter Brigitte McCann undercover to join the Raelian movement. Armed Raelian guards stopped her at the gate to the Quebec compound, and then a bishop ran up to her and said, quote, we're going to denounce Rael as a fraud. And McCann responded, quote, there's no way. And this, of course, was the correct answer. The bishop was testing her faith. Brigitte McCann lives in a tent on the compound and witnessed group sex, bizarre meditation rituals, and strange sexual behavior towards children, but nothing about cloning. In December 2003, Brigitte Boisselier approached Damien Marsick, her only team member in CloneAid. She told him that the first clone would be born on Christmas. This news shocked Damien, as they hadn't done any work in months, and Brigitte hadn't done any ever. She said a wealthy family had contacted her secretly and funded research and development since the U.S. government shut CloneAid down. Damien knew this was a lie, though, and he told her he didn't believe her, and she said, quote, we'll do it one day, so it's not really a lie. Damien left the movement shortly after this. On December 26, 2003, Brigitte announced that the first human clone, a baby girl named Eve, was born in an undisclosed location. The media was shocked. How did you do this? Where is she? Brigitte could not reveal the area or their methods, only that Eve was alive and healthy. And of course, we have to play a little clip of this announcement.
I'm very, very pleased to announce that the first baby clone is born. She was born yesterday at 11:55 a.m. in the country where she was born. So this will not give you more details about the location. She's fine. We call her Eve between us. You knew that, of course. Some suggested it, and I thought it was a good idea, actually. You won't have the right name. And you know, for a long time, I thought that this press conference will be with the baby, the parents, the scientist, everybody surrounding me and having pleasure announcing it. I'm alone. And there is a reason to that, is that...
Because it's a lie.
It hasn't been easy to face the world with this announcement. And with... We have been discussing with the parents the last 3 months how we would handle today. And they decided not to show up yet. They will. I hope they will. And I wish them well.
Total confidence.
I know.
In that press conference. I love how it's like, between announcing it, like, PM. Or she said, it's like, which one should I pick? AM or PM? Yeah.
Uh-huh. She's like, in the country she was born in.
Oh, man.
Brigitte. Hey, she's committed to the lie, though.
Oh, man. Well, in Florida, attorney Bernard Siegel saw Brigitte's press conference and was like, oh, my God, what's going on here? So he filed a civil suit against Clonaid, stating that if the baby did exist, which I think he kind of was like, well, there's a possibility maybe they were able to do this. And so he was starting to think about the legal repercussions of this. And so he was like, well, this baby's going to need an appointed guardian and medical services. So when Brigitte arrived in court, she not only tried to make her oath with her left hand when she had to testify for this civil suit.
This clip is so funny.
To which the judge repeatedly told her, quote, your other right hand.
But she just said, looks at him too. She's like, he's like, your other right hand, your other right hand. I think he says it like three times. Do we have a clip of that?
I don't.
No. Copyright? Ah, darn.
It's in the Netflix, though. Got it.
If you have the 4 hours of time,
yeah,
I would watch. It's interesting.
But they were like pressing her, like, where's this baby at? Because obviously they're trying to determine if the baby was born in the U.S. or in Florida, because the case would then apply to that. And she dodges the question a number of times. And finally she's like, oh, yeah, the baby's in Israel. And she couldn't say any more information, really, other than that. And it was pretty obvious to everybody at this point that this was a hoax. The judge said that if the baby was real, he didn't have the jurisdiction since she was allegedly in Israel, but mainly he didn't believe what she was saying at all. And to this day, as we keep saying, Brigitte maintains that Eve is real, though they don't speak much. And, you know, she had not even met her at any point during when all this was going down. She was like, oh, we video called a few times or something, but she had never actually been. It's like, really? You're the head of Clonaid, a part of this project, and you never got to meet the clone baby? Like, dude, red flag. Like, come on. But it's interesting because Rael is very, like, vague about the whole cloning thing. And honestly, it seems like he's distanced himself from it. And he's been quoted as saying, that's Brigitte's thing. So it's like, oh, yeah, that's not really my thing. That's just kind of like what she wanted to do. Again, she was like one of the higher ups in realism. So who really knows? But he was at Congress testifying for human cloning. So it's like, of course, when cat's out of the bag and this is a big lie and it looks stupid to believe in it, you are like, oh, yeah, I don't really know what's going
on
with that.
Let's just blame Brigitte.
Yeah, let's just blame Brigitte. So going back to Brigitte McCann, the woman that went undercover in the Raelian movement for 9 months, she was removed from the compound following the hoax, and her story brought legal issues from Canada because she was like, oh, I'm going to expose this, right? And as a result of her work, the group lost their tax-exempt status, and Rael had to flee again. This time, he found a home on the Japanese island of Okinawa. Rael has kept a very low profile since moving to Japan, and he still conducts speaking engagements over Zoom and oversees the Order of the Angels. Recently, he turned his attention to French-speaking African countries, where, you know, he's trying to spread the good word out there, and he's got a lot of fans out there in the French-speaking African countries. And it's interesting because he's manipulating them by saying, you know, you can follow me, but also he's promoting, which is not necessarily a bad thing, right? To, you know, go back to Africa prior to colonialism and practice your traditional religions and cultural ideas and stuff. But in the same token, privately, it's been said that Rael has been extremely racist towards Black people.
Yeah.
According to ex-members. So it's like, he's just manipulating people. He's just trying to get money from them and take advantage of them. And obviously it's more followers for him that feed his ego. And so he definitely has quite the following out in Africa. But the members who followed Rael to Japan were the most fervent in their beliefs, and in group meditations, they literally just sit in silence. And even his silence is enough to move some of his followers to tears.
Yeah, he makes them sit there and just listen to his silence.
He just sits there and he's listening.
Yeah, this is where the Vice documentary kind of picks up more on his latest
endeavors. I think he's living in Japan in that, that film, which that was done by a... It just plays on Vice. On the Vice channel, but it's an independent documentary.
Yeah, it's actually
film.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
For the most part, I mean, they didn't get into a lot of,
it wasn't really the history or the origin story and all the crimes. Mm-hmm. It was just more so like daily life of a Raelian basically.
And he's living big, man. He still parties. He's having a good old time out there. Tons of women around him. Yep. After all that.
Yeah.
Scot-free.
Well, the Canadian compound back in Quebec is mostly abandoned at this point, except for a few Raelians who run the mainly empty UFO land, which you can actually still visit. In 2018, the flying saucer was listed for sale, though we don't know if it was actually sold. It's like, oh, they're just trying to recoup some of that money now and move it to somewhere else. It's like, who's going to buy that thing? And how the hell are they going to even move that? Who's going to like put that on their lawn ornament?
How do you even move it out of there, too?
I don't know. Crazy stuff, man.
It is.
But Brigitte Boisselier lives in Las Vegas. She's living the high life, man. Though she'll stay with Rael in Japan for a few months at a time, she not only maintains that Eve is real, but that they've cloned babies in Holland, Japan, Australia, and South Korea. And of course, none of these have ever been confirmed. Just further lies, it seems like.
I would like to formally invite one of them on. If they would like.
Yeah.
One of the clones?
Yeah.
Oh, the clones.
Yeah.
I meant Brigitte. I was like, sure.
Well, sure, too. But mostly the clone.
Yeah. Yeah. Eve.
I think we'd all like to hear from the human clones.
Yeah. We'll pay you.
Oh, yeah. To come. For sure. We've got budget for that.
Yeah.
For the first human clone?
Hell yeah.
Of course we do. But yeah, it's interesting. She is, in her latest interview, still like 100% going with the lie. It's truly remarkable.
Yeah, and Rael's in his 70s, living his life in this compound that's been funded by a wealthy Japanese cult member of his. And again, there's those two documentaries. Definitely check them out. We'll link them for you if you want to know, you know, kind of dive into this from a visual aspect. I will say there is lots of nudity in there.
Yeah, it is.
And I not guess of children,
both of them
though,
together would be like 6 hours, so it's a lot. But
yeah, it's a lot of
interesting.
It's interesting that he even let them come in and film as much as they did.
I was surprised.
Like, he's just so
really
open
like,
about
especially
it.
Especially in the Vice one, they really troll on his ass. Like, there's some great edits in there.
Yeah, there are. But he has another young, I believe, Japanese woman named Lotus who kind of accompanies him. He's always got, like, pretty women around him, following him everywhere he goes. And in the Vice documentary, actually, she's told to watch what you say around the filmmaker. So he's got everybody, you know, under his control, and they still haven't built their embassy. They only have 11 more years to get that done. So they better get started.
Don't you feel like he set that date for 2035, considering he's what, 70-ish now? He's like, oh, I'll be like 85. Even if I'm still around, people aren't really going to come for an 85-year-old man if it all ended up being bullshit when the Elohim don't actually come.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Pretty convenient timing there, right?
Even though he claims they've saved $200 million for its construction, but they just need a country to welcome them.
Yeah, all right.
And so,
God,
you know, maybe it'll end up getting built in Africa or Japan. I don't know. I don't think any country is going to let them build this embassy, and I don't think they have the money to build it.
No, of course they don't.
They don't have the money. Their numbers are falling. Yeah. This is I think the positive is that this cult will likely not be around, especially once he goes.
Yeah, for sure.
I really don't see this continue. I don't think there's anybody.
Let's hope not.
Who's gonna like pick up the reins on this?
You know, it was one thing that he said that was so interesting too. In the Vice doc was he started talking about how at some point it started to, like recently, it started to annoy him that people around him were happy. And he's like, I get like upset and irritated by being around happy, smiling people. Just like, what the fuck is that?
Because he's not happy himself, no. Clearly. And he's probably dealing with a lot of internal things that he's done. You know, he's starting to get older and probably starting to reflect a little bit on what his life has been and what he's doing. Maybe, I could be completely wrong. He'd be like, it's not about that at all for him. And he's just mad because really he's getting old. And his alien...
Clone yourself, bro.
Friends haven't showed up yet.
You have the technology to live forever. Round two.
Why haven't they cloned him yet?
No, that's what I'm
saying. Or made a clone of him.
I don't get it.
To help him live forever. Because they ain't got no clones.
They ain't got no clones. You heard it first here, folks.
They ain't got no clones. They don't have anything. Just a bunch of sickos. And... Mr. Rael.
Yeah.
Honestly.
God, it's amazing how many crimes he got away to.
I can't believe. Disgusting. Yeah, I'm just shocked he hasn't.
Motherfucker should have been locked up.
Yeah, if they had locked him up, this cult would have died a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Fact that he's still just out living his life. Crazy. Well.
There you have it.
That's
the Raelians.
We want to hear from you. What do you think? Would you join? Do you believe in cloning? Do you think Eve is real? We want to hear your thoughts. Let us know what you think. I'm curious to hear from you all about how you think someone ends up in a situation like this, where they're fully manipulated by someone like Rael. What brings you to that point in life? And what do you think cult leaders like Rael are looking for in people to manipulate? What characteristics is the average cult leader seeking? Curious to hear.
Great questions. But before we go, I just want, you know, we never do this, but if you enjoy the Malhar podcast, please just take a moment, whatever you're watching or listening on, hit that subscribe button or follow button. It does really help us out. It's a free way to support the show. Ratings and reviews are nice as well. We always appreciate it, and we always appreciate all of your amazing comments. We really enjoy reading them and reflecting on the episode later on. But that is going to be it for us today. We'll catch you guys next time. And until then,
keep on taking your mind a mile higher.